Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading articles from the July issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. The 100 best westerns ever made. At long last, we update our definitive ranking of the greatest the genre has to offer. By Joe Layden. Under normal circumstances, the CNI crew adheres to a time-tested adage. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. In the case of our 100 best westerns ever made list, however, we figured it was way past time for an update. For one thing, the original list first appeared almost 20 years ago, in January 2002, to be precise, and since then more than a few list-worthy films have been released. Also, we have decided, reluctantly, we admit, to heed many requests that we restrict this list to theatrical features, and provide another rundown for television series, made-for-TV movies, and miniseries, including Lonesome Dove, in a future issue. Finally, during the pandemic lockdown, we've had time to rewatch and reevaluate scads of classic westerns. As a result, more than a few titles have moved higher on the list, and others are appearing for the first time. What follows is a roundup based on surveys of CNI staffers and readers, film critics, and actors and filmmakers who have a special affinity for the Western genre. And don't worry, we won't wait another two decades for an update. Number 1. Stagecoach, 1939. The disreputable doctor who cracks wise and drinks heavenly, but sobers up when the chips are down. The golden-haired shady lady who brightens incandescently when a naive cowpoke calls her a lady. The shifty-eyed gambler with a gun at his side and presumably an ace up his sleeve. And, of course, the square-jawed, slow-talking gunfighter who's willing to hang up his shooting irons, who's even agreeable to mending his ways and settling down on a small farm with a good woman, but not before he settles some unfinished business with the varmints who terminated his loved ones. Why? Because, as the gunfighter tersely notes, there are some things a man can't run away from. These and other familiar figures had already established themselves as archetypes by 1939, that magical movie year in which Stagecoach premiered. Even so, director John Ford's must-see masterwork arguably is the first significant Western of the talking pictures era, the paradigm that cast the mold, set the rules, and firmly established the dramatis personae for all later movies of its kind. Indeed, it single-handedly revived the genre after a long period of box office doldrums, elevating the Western to a new level of critical and popular acceptance. And, not incidentally, it made John Wayne a full-fledged movie star. 2. The Searchers, 1956. John Wayne gives one of his finest and most complex performances in John Ford's enduringly popular and influential Western as Ethan Edwards, a former Confederate soldier who's obsessively driven to recover his beloved niece after her family is killed and she is abducted by marauding Comanches. For years, he continues his search, accompanied by Marty, Jeffrey Hunter, a half-breed orphan raised to adulthood by Ethan's brother. And as they continue, however, Marty comes to question Ethan's fanaticism And the movie itself offers a darkly powerful counterpoint to the reassuring cliches of standard-issue horse operas. Even after 6 decades, Ford's film seems fresh and vital as it undermines audience assumptions about what to expect from Westerns in general, and a John Wayne movie in particular. 3. Shane, 1953. If you define a classic film as one that most people automatically assume they've seen, even if they haven't, because so many other movies have reprised its basic plot, then director George Stevens' Shane certainly qualifies for that label. Alan Ladd stars to perfection as Shane, a mysterious gunfighter who providentially appears in a Wyoming community just when the clash between homesteaders and cattle ranchers is turning uglier and bloodier. Truth to tell, Shane would like to put away his guns and put down some roots with a farming family. But a seriously mean galoot named Jack Wilson, Jack Palance in a career-defining performance, forces him to do, however reluctantly, what he's got to do. 4. My Darling Clementine, 1946. With all due respect to admirers of Tombstone and Gunfight at the OK Corral, both worthy films that appear later on this list, John Ford's unforgettable drama remains in a class by itself as a cinematic account of the legendary shootout involving Wyatt Earp, Henry Fonda, Doc Holliday, Victor Mature, and the Clanton clan, led by a startling, vicious Walter Brennan. As critic Roger Ebert noted, My Darling Clementine must be one of the sweetest and most good-hearted of all Westerns. The giveaway is the title, which is not about Wyatt or Doc or the gunfight, but about Clementine, played by Kathy Downs, certainly the most important thing to happen to Marshall Earp during the story. 5. The Magnificent Seven, 1960. Another sign of a classic Western. Whenever it pops up during a channel surf, you can't turn it off. In this case, whether it's near the beginning when Yul Brynner recruits his titular team of mercenaries, or when the Seven ride into a Mexican village they're hired to protect, to the pulse-quickening bump, 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 bump of Elmer Bernstein's score, or at the film's climax during the crackerjack shootout with the vicious raiders led by the demonic Calavera, Eli Wallach. You simply must keep watching. Whereas the previous 4 films on this list are justly lauded as cinematic art, The Magnificent Seven has no pretensions other than to being the ultimate cowboy popcorn movie. 6. High Noon, 1952. No classic Western divides movie fans more than High Noon. Carl Foreman, a blacklisted screenwriter, based the film on personal experience, hence the cold shoulder Marshal Will Kane receives when he asks his community for help. John Wayne and Hard Hawks were outraged that Kane would try to recruit amateurs into his fight, and made Rio Bravo to remind moviegoers how the West was won. But the public loved High Noon, with its vulnerable hero, Gary Cooper, who won the Best Actor Oscar, lovely newcomer Grace Kelly, and haunting theme song. The film was taut and suspenseful, its story told on the faces of its characters and with the relentless ticking clock. 7. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, 1969. Not that it matters, but the following story is true. William Goldman's history was a twist formula, mixes fact and legend to create a high-spirited adventure. Butch and Sundance may not have been as glib or good-looking as Paul Newman and Robert Redford, but Goldman's script stayed close to the facts as they're known, And if Butch and Sundance didn't really jump off that cliff to escape a posse, they should have. Redford and Newman's potent chemistry inspired legions of attempts at imitation. The duo single-handedly gave birth to the Buddy Film, and the enduring influence of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid can be found in movies as diverse as 48 Hours and Shanghai Noon. 8. Ride Lonesome, 1959. Randolph Scott and director Bub Bottecher collaborated on 7 memorable westerns between 1956 and 1960, but Ride Lonesome is considered by most aficionados to be the very best of the bunch. Scripted by Burt Kennedy, the film finds Scott perfectly cast as Ben Brigade, a bounty hunter who's determined to transport a captured outlaw, James Best, across Indian territory. 2 semi-reformed bandits, a pre-Bonanza Purnell Roberts and a callow James Coburn, want to wrest control of Brigade's captive in order to claim an amnesty offered for their own past crimes. But Brigade isn't interested in amnesty or even a reward. Rather, he wants to lure the outlaw's older brother, Lee Van Cleef, into a forced feeding of just desserts. 9. Dances with Wolves, 1990. We knew, we always knew, even while cheering for the cavalry in countless films, that history is written by the winners of the world's conflicts, and America's native population got a raw deal. With Dances with Wolves, we saw the other side of the tale, and how fitting it was through the eyes of an American soldier. Dances with Wolves became a personal crusade for Kevin Costner, who co-produced, directed, starred, and raised financing overseas after a string of Hollywood studios passed. His passion was rewarded with 7 Academy Awards and an awakening of our national conscience. 10. The Wild Bunch, 1969. The best opening credits sequence ever ends with William Holden growling, "If they move, kill 'em," followed by the sepia-toned freeze frame directed by Sam Peckinpah. Kinda says it all. The director's original 144-minute cut was trimmed almost immediately after the film's release, but it's been restored for the video and DVD release. The new scenes deepen the connection between Pike, Holden, and former Bunch member Thornton, Robert Ryan, now a bounty hunter on Holden's trail, and after 30 years we finally discover how Pike got that limp. 11. The Outlaw Josie Wales, 1976. It was the movie Clint Eastwood had to make before the impassive persona he created through the Sergio Leone films and his other signature character, Dirty Harry, became a typecasting trap. In his 1976 book, The Filming of the West, movie historian John Tuska predicted that Eastwood's career likely didn't have staying power. That same year, the outlaw Josie Wales introduced a new type of Eastwood character, still quiet, still deadly, but also compassionate and emotionally vulnerable. The title describes how society will judge Josie Wales, an outlaw only by circumstance, but when his quest is complete, he returns to being the farmer Josie Wales in a scene that offers hope for the future. 12. Destry Rides Again, 1939. Has there ever been a more unlikely romantic pairing than Jimmy Stewart's laid-back, milk-drinking lawman, Tom Destry, and Marlene Dietrich as the bawdy singer with a German accent and the inexplicable name of Frenchie? Destry Rides Again packs memorable songs, Dietrich's See What the Boys in the Back Room Will Have, and memorable scenes, a ferocious catfight between Dietrich and Una Merkel, into 94 flawless minutes. The movie would have been longer if certain lines had made it past the censors, such as when Dietrich wins a poker hand and drops the coins down her blouse, prompting a cowboy to quip, "There's gold in them thar hills." 13. Rio Bravo, 1959. Knowing Rio Bravo's connection to High Noon affords insight into an interesting slice of Hollywood history, but it's hardly a prerequisite to enjoy its rousing mix of action, comedy, romance, and music. Dean Martin and Angie Dickinson join old hands John Wayne and Walter Brennan, and if the casting of Ricky Nelson was a blatant attempt by Howard Hawks to boost the box office with teenage girls, at least the kid contributed a fine duet with Martin on the ballad My Rifle, My Pony, and Me. And look on the bright side. It could have been Fabian. 14. The Gunfighter, 1950. The fastest man with a gun who ever lived was a long, lean Texan named Ringo. We've seen gunfighters as heroes and villains, lawmen and mercenaries, but Jimmy Ringo, Gregory Peck, is the gunfighter as celebrity, trapped by fame, a subject of gossip, scorn, and adulation. Ringo can't order a drink at a bar without drawing attention. "He don't look so tough to me," sneers any number of envious punks. Famous last words. Red River, number 15, 1948. Red River appeals to those moviegoers who don't like westerns, but inevitably discover that, yes, John Wayne can act, and yes, movies about cowboys and cattle drives can be about more than cowboys and cattle drives. Allusions to Mutiny on the Bounty infuse the father-son conflict between Wayne and Montgomery Clift, and their climatic fistfight symbolizes their genuine old Hollywood versus young Hollywood rivalry. The happy ending divided audiences, but the director, Howard Hawks, liked both characters too much to let either perish, and it's hard to fault his decision. 16. The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, 1967. Recent scholarship has favored Once Upon a Time in the West as Sergio Leone's crowning work, but for those who can't separate the Leone oeuvre from its most famous character, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is the ultimate spaghetti western. It has all the signature elements: dusty, desolate vistas, amoral characters such as Tuco, Eli Wallach, who are motivated only by profit, a showdown in a circular arena, suggesting gladiators in a coliseum, an incomparable score whose whistling theme by Ennio Morricone is instantly recognizable, and Clint Eastwood as the serape-clad, cheroot-chomping man with no name. 17. The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, 1962. Rance Stoddard, James Stewart, plays a pitifully meek attorney incapable of killing sadistic outlaw Liberty Valance. But that's what history has recorded, because when the legend becomes fact, print the legend. Lee Marvin gives us a wonderful villain for the ages, and John Wayne impersonators picked up a staple for their act in the Duke's demeaning references to Stewart's character as Pilgrim. 18. Once Upon a Time in the West, 1969. Henry Fonda never struck us as the badass type, but in Sergio Leone's operatic follow-up to his Dollars trilogy, Fonda plays one of the most abhorrent hired guns ever. It's disturbing, like watching Mr. Rogers give a kid a wedgie. 40 minutes of cuts killed the original American release, but the film was finally restored to its full grandeur in 1984. 19. She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, 1949. So here they are, the dog-faced soldiers, the regulars, the 50-cents-a-day professionals, riding the outposts of the nation. The middle entry in John Ford's Calvary trilogy had his stock company at their most sentimental and featured Oscar-winning photography of Monument Valley in Technicolor. The Duke, whose inherent air of authority worked to his favor when he played older characters, found one of his most indelible roles as retiring officer Nathan Brittles. 20. The Hired Hand, 1971. 2 years after the smash success of Easy Rider, Peter Fonda used his newly developed muscle to direct and star in this unconventional Western, by turns lyrical and brutal, about two saddle tramps, Fonda and the great Warren Oates, whose friendship is tested when one attempts a reconciliation with the wife, Verna Bloom, he abandoned years earlier. 21. Unforgiven, 1992. In order to bring life to this project, Clint Eastwood traded on his status as the genre's last bankable star to get a Western made in a youth-driven market, then crafted a darkly poetic character study that found more to condemn than to celebrate in our Western myth. 22. Open Range, 2003. As grizzled cattle drivers who ride into danger while resting their herd near a small frontier town, Kevin Costner, who also directed, and Robert Duvall are a match made in Western movie lovers' heaven. 23. The Shootist, 1976. Though it's impossible to disconnect fact from fiction when E.W. Hostetler, Jimmy Stewart, tells John Bernard Books, John Wayne, "You've got cancer." Wayne succumbed to the disease in 1979. No movie star essayed a better final bow. 24. Tombstone, 1993. Tombstone's unpretentious balls-out gusto reminded us that a great Western didn't have to unfold on the grand scale of Lonesome Dove or Dances with Wolves. 25. True Grit, 1969. The Duke finally walked off with an Oscar as the irascible Marshal Rooster Cogburn. John Wayne called Rooster's recollections of his life to co-star Kim Darby, "the best scene I ever did." 26. The Virginian, 1929. It had been filmed twice before Gary Cooper played the title role in the first talking feature-length Western. It's Cooper's Virginian we remember for his star-making turn and the mustache-twirling of the villainous Walter Houston. 27. Winchester 73, 1960. Winchester 73, the story of the gun that won the West, follows Jimmy Stewart as he traces the provenance of his stolen rifle through a series of unsavory owners, all of whom are brought down by frontier karma. 28. Blazing Saddles, 1974. Mel Brooks's rude, crude masterpiece contained enough laugh-out-loud moments for 10 movies, from the infamous campfire scene to Madeline Kahn's show-stopping send-up of Marlene Dietrich. 29. Ford Apache, 1948. John Ford's Ford Apache inaugurated the landmark Calvary trilogy with a sobering reminder that sometimes the good guys don't win. 30. Angel and the Bad Man, 1947. Quirt Evans, John Wayne, on the vengeance trail, must choose between killing the man who murdered his father and settling down with a sweet farm girl played by Gail Russell, the hottest Quaker babe in movies. 31. Pat Garrett and the Billy the Kid, 1973. Sam Peckinpah's cult-vave revisionist Western showcases potent performances by James Coburn and Kris Kristofferson in the title roles. an exceptionally strong supporting cast, Slim Pickens, R.G. Armstrong, etc., and co-star Bob Dylan's affecting song, Knocking on Heaven's Door. 32. One-Eyed Jacks, 1961. This film never stood a chance back in 1961 when its star and director, Marlon Brando, spent 3 years fussing over every camera angle and line reading. Today, the backstory forgotten, we treasure this deceit-filled saga of two old partners in crime, one revenge-obsessed but still capable of redemption, the other hiding a savage nature behind a sheriff's badge. 33. The Great Train Robbery, 1903. This reenactment of a heist by the ever-popular Butch Cassidy and his Wild Bunch only a few years earlier signifies the true beginning of the Western. 34. The Naked Spur, 1963. Jimmy Stewart plays a bounty hunter who, when told his captive is innocent, replies, "It's him they're paying the reward on." Another intense psychological drama from Stewart and Anthony Mann. 35. Blood on the Moon, 1948. Moody and very dark, more film noir than horse opera, with Robert Mitchum as a long-haired drifter caught between warring ranchers and homesteaders. Mitchum, a shifty character in any setting, plays moral relativism so well that even when he does the right thing, you still don't trust him. 36. Geronimo, an American Legend, 1993. Best of the many film biographies of the famed Apache leader, with a star-making performance from Wes Studi as Geronimo. 37. The Big Trail, 1930. The Big Trail still deserves to be seen, not just for Duke's early career work, but for its remarkable widescreen panoramas and near cinema verite action scenes, including a river crossing in a fierce storm that almost drowned the cast. 38. A Fistful of Dollars, 1964. Henry Fonda, James Coburn, and Charles Bronson passed on the chance to play a nameless drifter in a Western reworking of the Japanese film Yojimbo. Director Sergio Leone settled for TV actor Clint Eastwood, who cashed a $15,000 paycheck for the movie that made him an international star. 39. The Professionals, 1966. A personal favorite of CNI reader favorite Anson Mount, writer-director Richard Brooks' hearty action-adventure has Lee Marvin, Burt Lancaster, Robert Ryan, and Woody Strode well cast as uniquely talented mercenaries hired to retrieve the kidnapped wife, Claudia Cardinale, of a wealthy rancher, Ralph Bellamy. 40. Appaloosa, 2008. We're still hoping for a sequel to this uncommonly satisfying old-fashioned Western, directed by and starring Ed Harris, about Virgil Cole Harris and Everett Hitch, Viggo Mortensen, veteran peacekeepers hired to establish law and order in a Wild West town controlled by a renegade rancher, Randall Bragg, Jeremy Irons. 41. Wind River, 2017. Writer-director Taylor Sheridan's excellent contemporary Western is at its very best during scenes shared by Jeremy Renner as a game tracker pressed into service to help solve a murder near a Native American reservation, and Gil Birmingham as the anguished father of the victim. City Slickers, 1991. A trio of Big Apple buddies, Billy Crystal, Daniel Stern, and Bruno Kirby, join Jack Palance's cattle drive and discover the one secret of life. Palance won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor, and a calf named Norman became the most beloved bovine since Ferdinand. 43, Duel in the Sun, 1946. Gone with the Wind, Western style. Gregory Peck and Jennifer Jones steam up the Arizona desert in jaw-dropping Technicolor. 44, Will Penny, 1968. A noble cowboy at twilight, beautifully photographed by Lucian Ballard and played by Charlton Heston, is one of his most understated performances. 45, 310 to Yuma, 1967. A companion piece to High Noon with a more charismatic villain. Someone has to watch captured outlaw Glenn Ford until the 310 train, but nobody wants the job except a desperate farmer, Van Heflin, who needs the $200 reward to feed his family. 46, Gunfight at the OK Corral, 1957. Burt Lancaster plays Wyatt Earp and Kirk Douglas plays Doc Holliday, and that's pretty much all you need to know. 47, El Dorado, 1967. El Dorado seemed an exercise in going through the motions, the second in a trilogy of Howard Hawks westerns between Rio Bravo and Rio Lobo, all starring John Wayne, in which the stories were more or less interchangeable. But Wayne, Robert Mitchum, and James Caan play the familiar material to a wink to each other and to the audience that is irresistible. 48. True Grit, 2010. Not so much a remake of the 1969 John Wayne classic as an equally entertaining but more faithful adaptation of Charles Portis's 1968 novel, written and directed by Joel and Ethan Coen, Fargo, with Jeff Bridges offering his own impressive take on grizzled lawman Rooster Cogburn. 49. Rio Grande, 1950. The final entry in John Ford's majestic Cavalry trilogy and the first teaming of John Wayne and Maureen O'Hara, a match made in movie heaven. 50. Support Your Local Sheriff, 1969. No one played the reluctant hero better than James Garner, whose easygoing charm fit perfectly in this delightful comedy.
Hello, this is Michael, reading from True West Magazine, from their archives, June 1955 edition. Nobody could ride that man-killing Geronimo horse. Nobody, that is, except the Bronc Buster from Texas, by Milburn C. Harper. The instant I saw that chunky little rider climb on the cattle chute fence, I had a presentiment that I knew him. I was sure he had not been around Kiowa before, but he sure looked familiar to me. During the spring and summer of 1901, before the Kiowa country was open to white settlement, I was employed as an agent for the Rock Island Railroad at Kiowa Station, now Hobart, Oklahoma. Kiowa was the principal cattle shipping station in that western country at that time. The railroad maintained large cattle shipping pens there. Saturdays and Sundays saw large droves of range horses being driven to the railroad stock pens for breaking as both cow ponies and workhorses. The bronc busting brought cowboys, cattlemen, and Indians from many miles around. Riding started early on Saturday and Sunday mornings and continued throughout the day. There was much rivalry among riders, and betting was heavy. The young riders got first chance at breaking the wild ones, and some of those babies got real rough. After several rounds of busting broncs for cowpony use, larger animals were broken for use as workhorses. These bigger broncs required seasoned riders, and some of the best riders were thrown and hurt. Word went around in town that a young outlaw stallion called Geronimo would be in the Kiowa pens for the third time. His owner wanted him broken, not only for breeding purposes, but for safety to other range horses. Geronimo was mighty tough. He had thrown and busted up half a dozen riders. One of my guests at that time was ex-Governor Richards, U.S. Assistant Secretary of the Interior. His party settled down in tents on the railroad right-of-way near the depot. The secretary spent a good deal of time in my office during his stay in Kiowa. He and his staff were greatly interested in the bronc riding contests. This particular Sunday, the secretary came in and remarked, "Seems like a good day for the contests. There's a lot of horses in the stock pens, and it won't be too hot. Let's get over early." "All right," I told the secretary, "let's go over and find a seat on the fence before it's covered with folks like a telegraph wire with blackbirds." When we arrived at the pens, the secretary noticed three men sitting off by themselves on the fence. They were talking earnestly. That's when I spotted the chunky fellow, one of the three, whose face was very familiar to me. I saw many cowboys watching them curiously and even heard them asking each other, "Who are these fellows?" Not even the old-timers knew them, it appeared. One leathery old cowpuncher remarked, "If those boys are bronc-busters, I'll bet that little short-legged monkey couldn't ride a billy goat." Secretary Richards and I watched a few contests, then walked around the pens. We came to a fine young stallion in a pen all by himself. The secretary looked him over with the eye of a horseman and declared, "This one will be hell to break. Just look at the muscles on him." I remembered seeing this stallion in the pens before. Several riders had tried to top him, and one had taken a bad fall. Soon, the very stud we'd been admiring was driven into the riding arena, and a mighty yell went up from the crowd. "Geronimo!" The owner, a ranchman from southwest of Kiowa, mounted the fence and waved his hat to attract attention. "Boys, I brought Geronimo here for the third time," he announced. "He's thrown every rider that topped him and hurt some of them pretty bad. I want him broken. First, because he's vicious and has killed more than one stud. He's too dangerous to be left in a herd on the range. Second, he has the blood, looks, and makeup for a good breeding stallion. I'm offering $100 to the man who can stay with him long enough to wear him down. However, I will not be responsible for damage done to any rider attempting to ride him. This is strictly up to the man who wants the $100 bad enough to risk his neck getting it." The cowboys whooped at the offer and then started collecting money among themselves to add to the purse. Finally, they got up another $100 to add to the ranchman's $100 as prize money for the man who successfully topped and cowed Geronimo. Secretary Richards and I walked over to where the boys were talking to the ranchman. The three strangers had just left his side when we arrived. The ranchman climbed the fence at once and made this announcement. "I have the pleasure to announce that Job Smith of Colonel Hughes's Red River Ranch in North Texas is about to tackle Geronimo. May he be the man to do the job." All around us, we heard folks asking, "Who is Job Smith?" Aided by his two buddies, Job got his own saddle, adjusted to his height and size. He was a little gent, standing barely 5'4". Geronimo was lassoed, tied to the fence, and saddled. Job got on the fence and jumped aboard the stud from the top rail. Geronimo was turned loose. Job, with a wild cowboy yell, slammed his spurs home into the stallion's flanks. At the rake of cold steel, Geronimo grunted and seemed to squat. For the space of a long breath, he held that stance, as if gripped by some tremendous muscular pain. Then suddenly, like a charge of dynamite exploding, he quit the earth in a body-shaking leap that put the saddle skirts to popping. He went straight up and high that first jump, tucked head and tail, and came down the same way. We heard the sledgehammer blows of his feet striking the earth and the loud whomp the air made in his belly as he landed. Then he took off across the corral, grunting and bawling and pitching. His leaps not so high now, but faster and harder. His every jump calculated to whip-snap the saddle against his rider's rump with pile-driver force. It wasn't the flashy, high-rolling, body-twisting sort of pitching that makes a great show, but seldom hurts a man if he can stick with his saddle. It was the heavy, chopping, bone-jarring kind that will set a man's nose and ears to bleeding, the kind that's been known to kill riders while still in the saddle. But it didn't kill Job. It didn't even set his noose to bleeding. He sat in his saddle like a monkey, always there, always spurring and yelling and waving his hat, yet never quite there either in time to catch solid those spine-shattering blows of the snapping saddle. Around and around they went. The horse, having lived on the open range, running and fighting, had the power and the wind, and he used it. But it was all wasted effort. Job was still there when Geronimo began to tire, spurring him again, forcing him to expend all the strength and fight that was left in him. Finally, in a lather of sweat, Geronimo gave it up. He stood in his tracks, panting and heaving, while little rivers of sweat ran down the insides of his legs. He could only wince when Job tried to spur more fight out of him. The secretary turned to me and said, "That's the damnedest bronc rider I ever saw." The owner came up and bridled his horse without trouble, then turned to Job and handed him the $100. "Job," he admitted, "I didn't think that you or any other living man could do it." "Thanks," said Job, looking admiringly at the broken stud. "That's a wonderful horse. I'd like to buy him." "Not for sale," the owner smiled. Cowboys and Indians crowded around Job, trying to shake his hand and congratulate him. When I finally got close enough to shake his hand, recognition came to me. He was little Job Smith, a schoolmate of mine, back in Mulberry, Arkansas, years before. I clearly remember the day he had said goodbye to us boys. "I'm going to Texas to punch cattle and ride broncos," he had said. He had done just that. A quiet, unassuming bronc rider, not a rodeo man. Job was delighted when I shook hands with him. I then introduced him to Secretary Richards as my old Arkansas schoolmate. The secretary smiled and said, "I didn't think Arkansas could turn out a rider like you." Job replied, "I sure thank you. Arkansas made me an ambitious boy, but Texas made me a bronc buster." By this time, the other boys had come up with their added purse, $100 and change. Job filled his pockets, then handed the balance to the other boys with him. Turning to me, he said, "Milburn, I sure am tickled to see you once more. I'd love to stay and have a good visit with you, but it's a good 150 miles to the Red River Ranch. That's a hard ride, and we must be on the way. Our horses will have to have rest and feed before we get there." I tried to persuade him and his buddies to come to the house and let Mrs. Harper fix them lunch before leaving, but he declined with thanks. Nowadays, my family likes to take in all the rodeos. They wonder why I'm not so enthusiastic as they about the bucking horse events. They can't realize I can never get the thrill out of them that I did back in the summer of 1901, when Job Smith made, in my opinion, the greatest ride in history. True West Magazine, June 1955 edition. Bare Fists versus Six Guns by Michael Kennedy. Unlike his chivalrous counterpart on television, the old-time frontier marshal was generally a nervous gent who'd put a 45 slug in your guts if you made a move toward pulling a gun on him. Frequent gun duels sharpened the marshal's skill, enhanced his prestige, and kept the local undertaker busy. This lethal arrangement worked out satisfactorily for everybody but the unlamented deceased. Most marshals followed this bloody pattern throughout their careers. Tom Smith worked differently, putting his bare fists against the six guns of lawbreakers. A handsome New York Irishman with the lithe build of a crack light heavyweight boxer, Smith could have been a success as a prize fighter. Instead, at the age of 24, he joined the New York Police Department and was assigned to a beat in the Bowery. Policemen patrolling the New York Bowery in the 1860s prided themselves on their fistic ability. A solid belt on the chin softened up an obstreperous hoodlum like magic, and a good officer never used his nightstick unless he was outnumbered 3 or 4 to 1. Among these hard-punching cops on the tough Bowery beat, Tom Smith soon rated tops. He won his letter in an epic brawl at Slick Charlie's Houston Street cockfighting joint by cleaning up three plug-ugly Bowery boys single-handedly. He walked out of that one, leaving all three unconscious on the dirty, sawdust-covered floor. Tom had his lumps, too, but most of them were on his knuckles. After 6 years on the Bowery, Tom Smith decided that he had had enough. He headed west in the spring of 1868 to get some clean air in my lungs, as he grimly expressed it. Dropping off the train at the hell-roaring cattle shipping center of Abilene, Kansas, Tom applied for the job of town marshal. The harried mayor of Abilene, T.C. Henry, refused to take a chance on a New York tenderfoot to ride herd on hard-bitten cowboys and gamblers. So Smith moved on. In 2 years, the Bowery ex-cop built a splendid reputation as a law officer in half a dozen wild mushroom towns in Wyoming and Colorado. He won his first job as peace officer and a permanent nickname at Bear River, Wyoming, by standing off a self-styled vigilance committee which had arrested one of Tom's fellow workers on a construction job. For that exploit, Tom was given the job of town marshal. Amazing reports of his unique method of law enforcement drifted back to Abilene, where the law was a monstrous joke to the citizens and a rapidly mounting tragedy to Mayor Henry and the city council. Time after time, the incredible reports insisted. The rock-fisted Irishman stood up the gunmen, crazy with rot-gut liquor and itching to kill, knocked them down and disarmed them. Bear River Tom packed a war club wallop in each fist, and soon the bad men and troublemakers learned to behave themselves. At Abilene, Mayor Henry gave up on his sixth town marshal in a row and wired to Kit Carson, Colorado, for Tom Smith to come and take over. Smith arrived on July 4th, 1870. Henry briefed the new marshal in his hotel room before bestowing the Silver Star of office. "You can't expect to maintain order in Abilene just by using your fists," warned the mayor. "Every desperado in town packs a gun and is ready to use it. And that goes for the cowboys, too, when they're drunk." "Why not take the guns away from everybody, then?" asked Smith. Henry shrugged helplessly. "We have a city ordinance on the books right now prohibiting the carrying of pistols. We can't enforce it." The Irishman accepted the star and carefully pinned it to the flap of his left shirt pocket. "I'll try to enforce your pistol ordinance for you, and without using a pistol to do it. As I see it, meeting gunplay with gunplay would only make a bad situation worse. You can't convince a man of the value of law and order by shooting him in the belly. See you later, Mayor." A blast of gunfire attracted Tom first to the Alamo Saloon. He entered to find a group of Texas cowboys, just in from the Chisholm Trail, engaged in target practice, shooting at a playing card tacked to the wall at the end of the bar. One puncher, as tall as Smith but thicker through the shoulders, had reloaded his gun and replaced it in the holster just as the marshal walked in. Tom approached him. "My name is Smith, the new marshal here. Sorry to spoil your fun, but you fellows are violating a city ordinance against carrying pistols. Turn your guns over to me, and you can pick them up at the mayor's office when you leave town." The burly Texan was drunk enough to be mean and dangerous. He weaved slightly in his high-heeled boots, glowering at the trim six-footer facing him. "So you're the new marshal, the rooster who's going to run Abilene from now on." Tom moved in close on the cowboy. "Look, mister," he said easily, "be sensible about this and don't make any trouble. Let's have that gun." The Texan crouched and stiffened in exaggerated gunfighter pose. "The hell you say," he snarled. "No red-haired son of a bitch wearing a tin badge is going to take my gun." Swiftly, his right hand dropped to the butt of his Colt, but the weapon was never drawn. Tom Smith's right fist socked into the cowboy's belly, whipped upward to his chin in a smashing uppercut. The Texan went down hard and stayed down. Marshall Smith bent over the KO'd trail rider and lifted his gun. He straightened quickly, ready for further trouble. But the dazed spectators grinned weakly and handed over their six guns. Tom removed a rawhide thong from his belt, slipped it through the trigger guards of the weapons, and walked out with a collection of hardware clanking at his side. The citizens of Abilene were deeply impressed by this performance, yet still not convinced that the fist-fighting newcomer was the right man for the marshal's job. Gamblers, reasoning that a man could get lucky once, offered even money that he couldn't repeat. A second test was needed to prove whether Tom Smith was a flash in the pan or the tough hombre he appeared to be. The townsfolk laid their bets and reserved judgment. They didn't have long to wait. News of the Texans' humiliating downfall reached the ears of one Wyoming Frank, a self-advertised bad man, camped with fellow trail riders on Chapman Creek, northeast of town. Frank, fortified by several snorts of red-eye, offered to bet $20 that the new fist-fighting marshal could not bulldoze him. One of Frank's comrades, a gent who had observed the new marshal in action at the Alamo Saloon, quickly covered the bet. Buckling on two guns, Frank mounted his horse and headed for town, whooping like a Comanche. Two of his pals rode along to see the fun when greenhorn Tom Smith got what was coming to him. The bold trio stalked into the Lone Star Saloon, where Frank bought a round of drinks and loudly announced his intention of running the new marshal plumb out of town. Nobody objected, so the boys left the Lone Star to hunt down their victim. Up Texas Street, they marched three abreast, with Frank bellowing for Tom Smith to show your ugly face or get out of town like any other polecat. Patrolling Texas Street on horseback, Smith heard his name shouted in this unflattering manner and dismounted. Tying his horse to the hitch rail in front of the old fruit saloon, Tom strolled unhurriedly to meet the name caller face to face. Frank's supporters caught sight of the oncoming marshal first and faded away like gun smoke, leaving the bad man strictly on his own. Spotting Smith himself, Frank kept moving forward, but his mouth went strangely dry and his bald invective stuck in his throat. "I hear you're looking for me," remarked Tom pleasantly, halting within punching distance of the cowboy. "Damn right I'm looking for you," blustered Frank, licking his lips. "I hear you aim to take my guns. No man can take my guns without shooting me first." Smith ignored the implied challenge. "Nobody is going to shoot anybody, mister. Hand over your guns before you get in trouble." Crowding Frank hard, never giving him a chance to draw, Tom herded his man clear across the board sidewalk and into a saloon. Mouthing profane threats, Frank retreated across the bar room until his back rubbed the bar and he could retreat no further. "You bastard," he yelled in frothing fury. "I'll..." His hands flashed to his gun butts as Tom Smith nailed him with a terrific 1-2. A piston left to his midriff, followed instantly by a bone-cracking right to the jaw. Wyoming Frank collapsed like an empty feed sack, head coming gently to rest in a spittoon. The marshal rubbed the stinging knuckles of his right hand gingerly against his shirt front, then bent to relieve the unconscious bad man of his artillery. Grinning broadly behind his walrus mustache, the barkeep came out from his post behind the mahogany and handed his six gun to Tom. "Reckon I won't need this old hog leg while you're marshal here," he declared. Each man in the place, including proddy young cowboys just arrived up trail from Texas, came forward at once to surrender his gun. The fist-fighting marshal had firmly established his right to rule Abilene. Magically under the new marshal, Abilene became an orderly, almost peaceful town, a decent place in which to live. Men behaved themselves at first, through sheer physical fear of Tom Smith. Later, when they came to understand the Marshals' high character and great hopes and plans for their community's future, they behaved themselves because it was the law and the right thing to do. "Give us another 2 years," enthused Smith to the mayor and city council, "and together we will make Abilene the best little city in Kansas." Tom Smith never got the 2 years he needed to make Abilene the best little city in Kansas, for on November 2nd, 1870, he was murdered. On that bleak fall day, Smith and a man named McDonald rode out on the prairie north of town to arrest settler Andy McConnell for killing his neighbor in a boundary dispute. McConnell was more than a little crazy, according to reports. Yet Tom went into the killer's dugout after McConnell had refused to come out on order. The settler shot the marshal with his rifle, while his partner, Moses Miles, fired through a loophole, scared off McDonald with a couple of close singing slugs. After McDonald had loped away to safety, the two settlers hacked, wounded Tom Smith to death with axes. Arrested next day by a posse of angry Abilene citizens, the murderers somehow escaped lynching. Tried by a court in another county, both killers drew only prison sentences. After Tom Smith's tragic death, Abilene lapsed quickly into its old wicked ways. Again, Mayor Henry frantically sought a new marshal to curb the gunplay and the general hell-raising, and this time came up with the famous gunfighter Wild Bill Hickok. Henry's selection of Hickok was unfortunate, since Wild Bill possessed neither the physical courage nor the incorruptible moral stamina of Tom Smith. Where the smiling New York Irishman had employed his instinctive knowledge of He-Man psychology and his mighty fists to enforce the law, Hickok depended on his killer's reputation, backed by his brace of Colts. It wasn't enough. Under Marshal Hickok's callous shoot-first, talk-later regime, Abilene deteriorated steadily until the booming Texas cattle trade moved on in 1873 to Ellsworth and left the town just another has-been cow capital. Today, the people of a revitalized Abilene hardly remember Wild Bill Hickok, but they will never forget Tom Smith. Years ago, they made sure of that by erecting a slab of granite with a bronze plate upon which is inscribed the following words: "Thomas J. Smith, Marshal of Abilene, 1870. Died a martyr to duty November 2nd, 1870. A fearless hero of frontier days who, in cowboy chaos, established the supremacy of law."
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.